All right, welcome everyone for the last session. Our next speaker is Francis Bach. Francis is a research director at INRIA and a member of the French Academy of Science. We've had multiple talks so far that talked about the theory B aspects of probabilistic programming, like denotational semantics, verification, and we've made a lot of progress on these questions, but we still have a lot to do on the more theory A aspect, simple complexity, understanding formal guarantees in the sense of bounds, for example, on simple complexity for probabilistic programming. So that's why I'm honored that Francis agreed to be here today and give a talk to this audience, because he's an expert, foremost expert in machine learning and the theory of machine learning, and he's going to talk to us today about formal guarantees in machine learning, statistics, and optimization. Welcome, Francis.
Thank you, Jean-Baptiste, for the introduction, and thank you also, Xavier and Jean-Baptiste, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. So today I'm going to talk about formal guarantees in machine learning and associated fields. And so to make things concrete, I will focus mostly on supervised learning, okay, to make things easy and easy to understand. But many of the things I will discuss are also applicable to other problems within machine learning. So I will first set up the stage for the classical supervised learning problem, and then I will mention a guarantee that can be obtained beyond the classical computational guarantees about like codes with a given speed and with no bugs. Like I will talk mostly about statistical guarantees and how well it predicts on unseen data, and focus on a posteriori guarantees that you can obtain once you have your estimator, and a priori guarantees more on the training algorithm itself. And then I'll finish with some guarantees for optimization, because many of the techniques that you use for machine learning are based one way or the other on optimization. So the setup, what is a classical supervised machine algorithm? It is an algorithm to build an algorithm for prediction. So the input of the algorithm is some data, xi, yi, so it can be XIs can be images, YIs can be labels. Okay, we call them input-output pairs. And of course, you have some prior knowledge about the problem. And the output is a function from X to Y, X being the set of inputs and Y being the set of outputs. So often the prediction function is itself an algorithm. Okay, so it's not it's a function that you implement on a computer. Okay, so machine learning gets as input data sets and outputs functions. So why is it difficult and interesting? The difficulty is that both the set X and Y can be very complex, can be images, can be molecules, can be protein, can be text, can be whatever you want. Y can be also very complex. The output could be a graph, could be another sentence, could be something complex. Also, the relationship between X and Y can be non-deterministic. So even before speaking about a probabilistic model that I will do in a moment, give me the same X, it may lead to different Ys, okay, in the training data. Of course, the relationship between X and Y can be quite complex. And above all, what you want to do is sometimes unclear. Okay, so for unsupervised learning, it's very unclear. For the supervised case, it's a bit clearer. And the goal of the next slide is to highlight one way of formalizing what people want to do. So again, so this is a classical learning pipeline. And there are two types of performance criteria. There are the classical, like computer science criteria. I want my algorithm to train and my function at test time to be fast and with given memory consumption. You may want to certify that, okay? So I guess we have had a few talks about this. But from the learning point of view, for us, the difficulty is the other type of performance. This is what I will call the statistical performance, how well it does on unseen data. Okay, so the doing well on training data is just a mean to an end. You just want to do well on testing data. And for that, you have to define what I mean by that. So typically, the testing data is either a subset of pairs of X and Ys or a distribution, depending on the context. And for this talk, I'm going to assume that some loss is given, and I will mention losses in a moment. So I have a criterion, okay, given to me by the user that I want to minimize on my testing data. All right, so what is a classical performer that people use? So here I focus on the simplest example, which is the expected risk. So this is the average risk on the testing data, but you can imagine like many other things beyond that. For example, if you take as a, if your output is a discrete object and the loss is one if you're different and zero otherwise, if you take the average of that loss, you get the error rate. Okay, so one minus the accuracy. And if you do a regression, often you take square loss between y and f of x, and you get the mean square error. So this is the classical classical expected risks. So we know, once we know what is the expected risk, we should first focus on what is the optimal thing to do. And there's a very classical thing, a nice book by Devroy, Lugosi, and Yorfi. And the optimal thing to do is so-called the Bayes predictor, which is the argmin of, this, of that risk. Essentially, for every x, you look at the conditional probability of y given x, and you select the z, which minimal expected loss. Okay. So if you are doing classification, you just take the label with the maximal a posteriori probability. And if you do regression, this is just the conditional expectation of y given x. Okay. So the natural optimal predictions. So why isn't machine learning already solved? Because I have the optimal prediction. Because to do this, to compute this, you need to have access to P of Y given X. And of course, you don't have access to this at test time. So this is why there's still something to do. As one thing first is this will be our criterion. But you typically have two. It comes in two flavors. Okay, either you want the risk to be certified. Okay, I want on unseen data to make fewer than 1% of mistakes on average. So this is often what you would care as a user. But when you want to certify a training algorithm, our goal as statisticians or machine learners is that given the data, I do the best that I can. Okay, and the best that I could is this minimum minimum risk. That minimum risk may not be zero. Okay, so often when you look at, let's say, computer vision, you may be led to believe that an image is a cat or a dog. Okay, this is probably true. But if you work in biology, given like given your blood sample, okay, whether you're going to have cancer in 10 years or not is not the deterministic variable. Okay, so the mistake that you could make, the best performance will not be zero. Okay, so it's in many problems, the best is not zero, okay? And this R of F star is not zero, and the goal of statistics and machine learning is to achieve the best that you can. So when you want to certify, you provide guarantees for a training algorithm, this is going to be on the excess risk, the difference between our test performance minus the optimal test performance. Okay, so this is quite different. This is, we want to certify that. All right, so let's look at algorithms. Okay, so the goal is to achieve a good risk on unseen data, and they come in mostly two flavors. So the one based on local averaging and one based on the optimization on the training data. So let me present those two types. So local averaging is a very basic principle. We know if we knew P of Y given X, then we will know how to compute the optimal prediction function. For example, here, for the square loss, this will be the conditional expectation. So the task of supervised learning is to compute conditional expectation. And one way of doing this is to approximate this P of Y given X by something and just use the expectation. This is essentially what k-nearest neighbor is doing, or kernel regression, like Nadaraya-Watson. Essentially, you look for a given X, so this X, you look at data around you, okay, and you're going to predict essentially like data around you by assigning to your close-by points a weight and defining this P of Y given X based on the labels of points around you. Okay, this is k-nearest neighbor. So there's no training. You just look at the data and predict. There's a formula. Of course, there's always one hyperparameter to decide how many points I take. It's a k in k-nearest neighbor. And that's it. Okay, this is a very simple technique that has been around for quite a while. But there is another type of techniques which are based on optimization. So you have some data, and you're going to compute the loss that you will compute at test time, but you compute it on your training data, and you try to minimize it. Okay, and as soon as you say minimization, you have to parameterize F, so there are many possible Fs. So the simplest one is the linear model. So you build a set of features based on your expert knowledge, and you combine them linearly, and you have as many parameters as you have features, but you can be more complex. You can have a lot of those features, infinitely many, and we get back to this area of kernel methods, or you can build a neural network, and I'm sure you have seen neural nets before in this workshop. So here, to avoid overfitting, you need some form of capacity control, either small number of parameters, or you constrain the norm. So there are various ways of doing it. It's not the topic of today. Or you can also have some algorithmic ways of regularizing by not running your algorithm up to convergence. So there are many ways, and it's a very active topic in machine learning. But here, for this audience, just like you need to control the capacity, and this will come back later when we want to talk about formal guarantees. So here, training is not a formula. You have to optimize, and this leads to a flurry of interesting problems for computer science and applied mathematics, because this can be quite slow. So you want to be fast, and you may want to certify that you have optimized your function. Okay, so you may want to make sure that you achieve the minimum of the empirical risk, and this will be the topic of the last part of the talk. All right, so now we have the setup. We have our training algorithms. What can we say about guarantees? So here, we mostly focus on the evaluation of the statistical performance, and just to present the basic results, okay, which are mostly based on one tool. We could do better, but this is here Hoeffding's inequality, which will be an inequality that will essentially be like the central limit theorem, but with in a non-asymptotic way, with exact bounds. So the way it works is that if you give me your prediction function obtained from wherever, and you have access to m independent data points, so here they have to be. So here we assume that the test data comes in the form of a distribution, and I have ID samples from that distribution, m of them. Then, if I compute the empirical risk on my testing data, I know that my expected risk will be less than this, plus your usual usual deviation between the empirical mean and the expectation, which is of the order 1 over root m. Okay, this is a classical 1 over root m bound. And because I've used Hoeffding's inequality, I can quantify exactly, I can certify, if you give me a probability that I will be wrong, like delta, then the probability of 1 minus delta, then the deviation between those two is 1 over square root of m, times the maximal potential loss, but for the 0-1 loss, this is just 1, times the square root of log of 1 over delta. So the key here is that the dependence on this probabilistic parameter is very weak. Okay, but it's logarithmic, so if you go from 1% to 1 over 1,000, you don't pay that much. Okay, so from that, you can, if you have enough testing data, you can certify the output of your testing, your prediction function. One thing to keep in mind is that this will be very important in a moment when we take into account training data, that if you make multiple comparisons in those probabilistic statements, you have to correct for multiple comparisons. So if I do t comparisons, then I have to apply all of that with 1 minus delta over t, so that I can apply the union bound at the end. So essentially, if I make t tests, I'm going to replace log of 1 over delta by log of t over delta. So this is, you add something which is of log t. So when you compare two models only, that's fine. 10, that's fine. But when you go to 1 million, that's not fine. Okay, so this is very important that all of those like probabilistic statements are based first on this assumption of independent data. And this may be true or may not be true for your situation. Maybe the test data that you have is not of that form. And if you make multiple comparisons, you have to be careful. But this requires to have some testing data. Would it be possible to do this only for the training data? Okay, I have like, in a sense, you don't want to waste testing data to certify your algorithm. Can you do this directly on the training data? So this you can in some sense, but this will always come with some assumptions. Okay, and those assumptions are often not verifiable. Understand that if you need the data to be ID, there is no way to certify that the data is ID. It's an assumption that you have to make on the data. So let's see how this works. Okay, I have training data only, ID from the testing distribution. So I assume here, very importantly, I have a link between train and test. Okay, so this is what we always do when you do statistics or learning theory. But in practice, this is rarely the case. You often have some shift between training and testing. You have many things that can happen. But if you want guarantees based on the training data, there has to be a link. And the most classical link is the identity of the distributions. So now, exact same band as before. Okay, if I select my predictor f hat among t functions, I had t candidates, I select the best t, exact same band as before. The expected risk will be less than the empirical risk plus the usual 1 over square root of n deviation times my log t. Okay, so if I have only 10 predictors, then that's totally fine. But typically, when we do empirical risk minimization in a, let's say, neural network, I have like 1 million parameters which are real valued. Okay, so if you're willing to encode the reals like in 8 bits, that's a lot. T tends to be very, very large. Okay, this very naive bound will not work at all. Just based on the union bound, it's not enough. But there are tools which are called uniform concentration inequalities, which essentially are here to provide the same certificate uniformly over a large class of functions. Okay, so this is if I have a class of f of theta and parameterized by some parameter theta which could live like in a vector space, then I have the exact same bound, okay, that the for all theta simultaneously, okay, so you have to be careful about the quantifier here, all f simultaneously, and then for my estimate, since this is true for all f, as long as my estimate is inside that class, this will be true as well for my estimate. This is where you can avoid the dependency between the data and theta. When you learn, theta depends on x, y, y, so you don't have independence. But if you take a uniform over a whole class, you can still do it. And you get the usual 1 over root n performance, but now you get an extra complexity parameter, and this is what is essentially characterizing what we call the capacity of the function class. So often associated to the number of parameters, but not only. Typically, if you work on the vector space, the size of the ball where your parameters live in. So typically, this is of order 1 over root n or something that decays with n. And the good thing about that is that if you can compute Cn, okay, often you can because your function class, you know it, you have decided your model. Okay, so you take a model for which you can compute Cn, and this can be computed. And this gives you a posterior guarantees, even if you learn over a very large class of functions. So here I presented like one version based on a Hövding inequality, and typically this is a tool, Cn is computed what is called a Rademacher average, but there are many other ways of doing it. Okay, and one classical one is using Pike Bayesian analysis, and a very nice tutorial by Pierre Alquier. So there are tools to do those forms of a posteriori guarantee. So at the end, it's going to work if n is very large. Okay, so clearly, if n is 1,000 or 100, don't expect that your bound is non-trivial. What do I mean by non-trivial? So here, if our loss is between 0 and 1, and my guarantee is above 1, this is what I call a trivial bound. Okay, so if you apply those types of bounds when n is too small, it's likely that the overall term is bigger than 1, and you're certifying something which is totally useless. But if n is large enough, and your model class is well chosen, adapted to your problem, then this is something that can lean in practice. And there are like papers showing that you get like, particularly if you do natural language processing, where n is a billion, typically you get like nice error bounds. All right, so it's only important. Okay, this is just almost obvious, but it's good recall that you can only use the test distribution once. Okay, you're not allowed to use a test set to find your parameters. And most importantly, all of those are based on assumptions. Okay, so if they are violated, it's hard to say what you can do. So you can relax them a bit by introducing some dependence among the samples. This is possible, but you have to quantify it. How is difficult in practice. You can also have some form of domain adaptation by allowing test and train to be different, but then you have to quantify it. So overall, it's quite difficult to provide any certificate unless you make this strong IID assumption. Right, let's now look at guarantees for training algorithms. Okay, so now the goal is not to certify a posteriori a given predictor. It is, can we know in advance that we're going to do well? Okay, this is more, it's really my job or the job of my team to do provide such guarantees. Okay, so how does it work? We're given a class of distributions, P of XY. So we'll see in a moment that there is no free lunch. For sure, no free lunch. If you want to get all distribution, all X and Y, that's not possible. Given some data, you have some estimator, and you want that the excess risk goes to zero as n goes to infinity. Okay, so you don't really care that the best estimator is good or bad. It's not your problem. Okay, you just want to do as well as the best estimator. And if possible, you want to quantify it. So here, those guarantees will be a priori. Okay, so even before I start to see the first data point, I want to get guarantees in advance. Okay, so this is what we would like to have, but in most cases, those guarantees will depend on quantities you don't know. Okay, so they are of low practical value. Okay, unless you know about your data, sometimes it's okay. So if you assume the data are bundled, this can be okay. But if you assume that if you make any assumption on the relationship between Y and X, typically this is an assumption, and so those bounds, at least for training algorithms, will not lead to any form of guarantees which you can implement in practice. So first, the no free lunch theorem, so from the same book by DeVroy, second edition, is just saying that all algorithms must have weaknesses. Okay, so if somebody, let's say from deep learning, tells you that neural net is always the best. It's fake news, as we say. Okay, so this is one example of that no free lunch theorem. And in the simplest setup, give me any x input set which is infinite, take the 0-1 loss, consider all problems, all learning problems on that x and 0-1, generate data ID from the distribution p. And if you give me any sequence that goes to zero. Okay, so arbitrarily slowly, so 1 over log 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 n, so it goes to zero, but it's very slowly. Then give me your best learning algorithm, like super deep net. Then I will find a distribution for which the expected risk compared to the optimal one will be at least my very slowly decaying sequence. In fact, in the proof, R star is zero. Okay, so in a sense, you can make the performance be as bad as you want. Okay, so here you have to be careful of the ordering of the classifiers. Give me an algorithm, I can find a distribution. Okay, so this is just one example that all algorithms must have weaknesses. Okay, so this is important because if you want to get guarantees on a learning algorithm, they will need to have some assumptions. Okay, so you can have this notion of universal consistency, something that works all the time if n is large enough, but if you want to guarantee the time it takes, so you want an an which you know in advance, okay, you have to make some assumptions, and this is what we're going to do now. So one way to make assumptions which are like a bit more visible is to concentrate on RD. Okay, so you can apply that to other sets, but RD has a simplicity of being like well known, and we're going to make assumptions now on the problem and on the relationship between Y and X. Okay, so here, F star, the optimal performance. For example, in the context of regression, the conditional expectation of Y given X, we're going to assume it's regular enough. Okay, so Lipschitz continuous. Okay, it's a weak assumption, but it will already lead to complex problems. So let's look at what we can say. So there is a nice lower bound on worst case performance that gives me an algorithm again. Then there exists a P, a distribution for which X is uniform, in fact, on the unit ball, and F star will be Lipschitz continuous for which your excess risk will go to zero, but at a speed which is very slow. Why is it very slow? Because its dependence in dimension is really not nice, because if you forget the 2s, it's 1 over n to the power 1 over d. Okay, so let's take d being 10, it's a very small d, but 1 over n to the power 0.1 goes to 0, but you can try it out in your computer. It's very, very slow. Okay, very, very, very slow. And if d is 100, it's even slower. Okay, so this shows that if you want to achieve some excess risk epsilon, if I invert this relationship with respect to epsilon and n has to be exponential in dimension. Okay, so this is a classical curse of dimensionality. If I make no assumptions whatsoever on my problem, I'm bound to have worst case guarantees, which are quite bad. So this is unavoidable, but thankfully we have been working on the problem for the statistics and the machine learning community has been working on it for quite a while, and there are extra assumptions that we can make to lower this curse of dimensionality, and I will mention a few of them now. So one is the support of inputs. If your data is in high dimensions but happens to occupy only a small space, if your function f is smoother, that will help. And also, if your function space, if your f star is in fact depends only on a small number of variables, this we will be able to leverage that if possible. So let's look at the support of inputs. So this is very classical. Even the nice digits, I think the previous talk has some nice digits. Okay, so I think 16 by 16, from what I remember. And if you do look at that, there's always a black box surrounding the digit. So all the pixels at the border are always equal to always black. So this means that your data occupy a small dimensional subspace. Okay, so this is very classical, that you can the data does not live in a doesn't have like a non-empty interior. Okay, so you often have a subspace, or you may have sometimes a manifold. Okay, so here on the right, this is a circle manifold. It's very common that the data lives on a small dimensional manifold. Small can be, so here it's one dimensional, but often can be a bit higher. And here what we hope, and this is what can be achieved in practice, that in learning, you're not going to pay the price of the ambient dimension D, but the price of the data dimension R. And this happens to be the case. Most algorithms, the ones I have presented, K-nearest neighbor, or even like neural net, will be adaptive to that. Okay, so if you give it the proper hyperparameters, you will end up with a rate of convergence that will not depend on D, but on R. Okay, so this is one improvement. And so this is one good thing about learning algorithms, that they are sometimes adaptive to this lower dimensional subspace. Other classical way of obtaining better bounds is to assume some smoothness of the optimal function. Okay, so here on the left, it's a basic one-dimensional regression problem where y given x is totally non-smooth, not even continuous, and on the right, a smooth problem. And you should expect that for the right problem, you converge quicker than for the non-smooth problem. Okay, and typically, this is being formalized by having higher order derivatives which are bounded, s. And this is the case as well. Okay, if you essentially replace d in the bounds by d over s. Okay, so this is this nice books by Gyorfi and Sibakov. And so this means that if s is large, if you're very, very smooth, s is of the order of d, for example, then you totally lose the curse of dimensionality. Okay, so this is one nice aspect of the problem. One caveat, the constant. Okay, I have not talked about the constant. The constant in front will typically be exponential in d, but the dependence on number of samples will be typically better. So here, depending on your algorithm, you may or may not adapt to it. In particular, if you do nearest neighbors, will not be adaptive to this. Even if your dependence of y given x is very smooth, you're not going to find it. Okay, so this is why nearest neighbors are quite not adaptive in any form of high-dimensional problem, because even if you have a linear model, if your function is linear, you won't be able to predict correctly. Whereas neural networks and kernel methods are adaptive to this. Okay, so this is one reason why those two techniques, kernel methods and neural nets, are still runnable on high dimensions, because if your target function is smooth, you're going to do well. And the final one is latent variables. So if your y given x depends only on a projection of your data, either linear projections or nonlinear projections. So here on the y, y given x depends on both x1 and x2. And here on that problem, y depends only on one direction. And what we hope is that we're going to play the price not of d, the ambient dimension, but only on r, the size of my latent variable. And this is what you can achieve, in fact, for some setups. And for this one, this will only be true for neural nets. Okay, so only neural networks, if you can optimize correctly, will be adaptive to this like latent variable. So often people say they do learn representations. And in this very abstract context, when you have latent variables, neural nets will find them if you can optimize correctly. Okay, so this is a whole different area. But this is, so at the end, so if you want to get some adaptivity, so what do I mean by adaptivity? Is the fact that I don't want to know in advance if I'm going to be in such or such situation. I don't want to know in advance what should be the subspace where the data live. I want my algorithm to learn it by itself. Okay, so by just finding the correct hyperparameter, typically like number of parameters, for example, then you want to benefit from an assumption without ever telling the algorithm what you meant. And what I've just alluded to is that in terms of like superiority of algorithms over others, at least for that metric, so neural nets are superior. If you can optimize them, then you have kernel methods, then you have local averaging. Because this one is only adaptive to small support. This one is adaptive small support and smoothness. And this one is adaptive to everything. And so this is just to give you a flavor of the type of guarantees that you can obtain. They are all a priori guarantees, which are just telling you that if this happens on your data, this is going to work well, but they cannot be transformed into like formal guarantees. So for the last 5 minutes, let me talk about optimization, because many of the techniques for learning are obtained from optimization. So there are two different classes of functions, the easy one, the convex ones, and the non-convex ones. Let me focus mostly on the convex ones. So in a learning problem, when I'm minimizing the empirical risk, this will be convex if the loss is convex, and typically the loss is convex if you use like a least squares or logistic regression, and if your model is a linear model. Okay, so you have to specify a very small class of model, a small, you cannot do neural nets. And the consequence here is that you get efficient algorithms with provable guarantees, which are both a priori and a posteriori. Okay, so this is very good. It's essentially like numerical linear algebra. You can guarantee even before you start to optimize, you look at the problem, you can say it's going to take me that amount of time to reach epsilon precision. Of course, assuming you can do linear algebra perfectly, it's a different story. You get both a priori and a posteriori guarantees. So let's look at the various algorithms to give you a flavor of what can be achieved. So here we minimize the finite sum, and this is a classical specificity of machine learning, is that we are not any problem in optimization, we have finite sums. So let's try to leverage finite sums. So the first algorithm, which is not leveraging finite sums, is gradient descent, okay, quite old, where you go down the negative gradient. So this is a 2D problem, you start here, you make one gradient direction, which is orthogonal to the level sets, you make a big step, and you go on. Okay, so you converge quickly. But every step of the algorithm, you need to compute the full gradient of the function g, and this requires to look at your whole data. So this takes forever if n is very large. And what has been promoted since like the last 70 years is to use a stochastic gradient descent, which is not a descent technique, by the way, but it's still called a gradient descent, where instead of selecting all functions hi and averaging over them, I just select one of them. And if you do that, you see that you don't always go down, but quickly you converge to the vicinity of the optimal value, and that's largely enough for us. So this is like classical algorithms, and in the convex case, you can do a bit better. This is like work which I've worked on like in the last 10 years. It's called variance reduction. The idea is that this algorithm, we have fast iterations because at every step, I select a single edge. So by design, I have a good dependence on n, but this a single stochastic gradient has a high variance. okay, because the tensor has variance, because it's one out of n. And the idea that it's possible to add terms that will reduce the variance. Okay, I will not describe what those terms are, but you can add terms depending on your past information that will reduce the variance and help you converge quicker. Okay, so this is not, I don't want to spend too much time, but if you have a convex function, then you can have like algorithms which will both have the nice aspect of being cheap for each iteration, but also be converging exponentially fast. So what do I mean by that? I mean that those are guarantees where there's nothing hidden. Okay, so here, this is, we look at complexity of algorithms by number of gradient accesses. Okay, so you give me your data, okay, compute a few statistics. So typically for machine learning, the norms of your features, okay. Remember that here I have a linear model, and then the number of iterations that you need to reach precision epsilon with respect to the best theta in your class is a constant, universal, nothing hidden, probably not one, maybe two or four, times this. Okay, and this condition number can be computed. Essentially, this is proportional to n in machine learning in most situations. And you can see the various algorithms. So SGD has no dependence in n. Okay, so to reach precision epsilon, you don't need, there's no n in the complexity, but the dependence in epsilon is bad. Okay, so if you want epsilon to be quite small, you will need many iterations, whereas gradient descent will be a bit the opposite. You have a logarithmic dependence in epsilon, so if you want to achieve small epsilon, this is going to be okay, but then you pay the price in n. And those variance-reduced techniques get the best of both worlds. The dependence is not anymore a product, but a sum, and when k is of the order of n, this is a strong gain, and you get exponential convergence. So this is a nice aspect of convex optimization is that you can get, those are a priori guarantees, but you can also get a posteriori guarantees by convex duality. So this is really the case where things are very nice. And even better, it works as advertised. Okay, so typically, let me skip that one, but it works quite well both in theory, so this is not this is a fake plot, and in practice. Well, so let me just finish on the non-convex optimization, because this is closer to research at the moment. So if you start to have a non-convex problem, okay, what I had here, where any stupid algorithm will end up ending there, okay, starting from anywhere, it's not true anymore, okay, because this is a global optimum, global minimum, but depending on where you start, you can end up in a local minima or a stationary point. So people have worked on local guarantees. Can I avoid at least the bad stationary points? Can I avoid being there, for example? Okay, but this is still local. People have tried to be global, but this is not possible because you can always get functions of that kind, which is flat everywhere, except in a small region. And to optimize that based on local information, you have to be lucky to get into that region, and the volume of that region tends to be exponentially small. Okay, so there's no possibility. So in a sense, if you go non-convex, in convex everything was super easy. In non-convex everything becomes super hard. And there are two lines of work which we are working on and part of the community is working on. It's way to focus not on functions like that, nobody cares about those, but on neural networks. At the moment, nobody has been able to achieve like a guaranteed polynomial time training for even the simplest neural nets, by simplest, at least one hidden layer. At the moment, what we have as results is only qualitative if the number of parameters go to infinity. So in the over-parameterized regime, you avoid local minima, okay, but there's nothing quantitative, and it's still quite an active area of work. Another area, let me skip it. So to conclude, so I've tried to describe what guarantees you can get for machine learning and try to make things clear between computational guarantees, which are important, which are in a sense, this is like without those guarantees, nothing can be done. Okay, but what we are focusing on is more on the statistical guarantees, that how well it predicts on testing data. Two different types of guarantees. Guarantees a posteriori on your estimator that you have, that you want to deploy. So this is based typically on computing the test error on test data. But you may also want to guarantee something about your training algorithm, how well it will perform even before you start the data. Of course, many open problems, okay, the interface between machine learning and guarantees. I think in this workshop, a lot of probabilistic programming. I'm not sure there was a talk on robust optimization, but it's also something which is very interesting, try to go beyond this average error rate as being the metric, and of course, many others. Thank you for your attention.